A Concise History of Turkey. The History and Legacy of Turkey from Antiquity to Today. Written by Charles River Editors. Narrated by David Pickering. Introduction. Lying in the middle of a plain in modern-day Iran is a forgotten ancient city, Persepolis. Built 2,500 years ago, it was known in its day as the richest city under the sun. Persepolis was the capital of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, the largest empire the world had ever seen, but after its destruction it was largely forgotten for nearly 2,000 years, and the lives and achievements of those who built it were almost entirely erased from history. Alexander the Great's troops razed the city to the ground in a drunken riot to celebrate the conquest of the capital, after which time and sand buried it for centuries. It was not until the excavations of the 1930s that many of the relics, reliefs, and clay tablets that offer so much information about Persian life could be studied for the first time. Through archaeological remains, ancient texts, and work by a new generation of historians, a picture can today be built of this remarkable civilization and their capital city. Although the city had been destroyed, the legacy of the Persians survived, even as they mostly remain an enigma to the West and are not nearly as well understood as the Greeks, Romans, or Egyptians. In a sense, the Achaemenid Persian Empire holds some of the most enduring mysteries of ancient civilization. Of course, one of the reasons the Persians aren't remembered like the Greeks is because of the way the Greco-Persian Wars ended. The ancient Greeks have long been considered the forefathers of modern Western civilization, but the Golden Age of Athens and the spread of Greek influence across much of the known world only occurred due to the Greeks' victory in two of history's most important wars. In 491 BCE, following a successful invasion of Thrace over the Hellespont, the Persian Emperor Darius sent envoys to the main Greek city-states, including Sparta and Athens, demanding tokens of earth and water as symbols of submission, but Darius didn't exactly get the reply he sought. According to Herodotus in his famous histories, Xerxes, however, had not sent to Athens or to Sparta heralds to demand the gift of earth, and for this reason, namely because at the former time when Darius had sent for this very purpose, the one people threw the men who made the demand into the pit, and the others into a well, and bade them take from thence earth and water, and bear them to the king. Thus, in 490 BCE, after the revolt in Ionia had been crushed, Darius sent his general Mardonius, at the head of a massive fleet and invading force, to destroy the meddlesome Greeks, starting with Athens. The Persian army, numbering anywhere between 30,000 and 300,000 men, landed on the plain at Marathon, a few dozen miles from Athens, where an Athenian army of 10,000 hoplite heavy infantry, supported by 1,000 Plataeans, prepared to contest their passage. The Athenians appealed to the Spartans for help, but the Spartans dithered. According to the laws of Lycurgus, they were forbidden to march until the waxing moon was full. Accordingly, their army arrived too late. Thus it fell upon the Athenians to shoulder the burden. With their army led by the great generals Miltiades and Themistocles, the Athenians charged the outnumbering Persians. Outmatched by the might of the heavy, bronze-armoured Greek phalanx, the inferior Persian infantry was enveloped and destroyed, causing them to flee for their ships in panic. The Athenians had won a colossal victory against an overwhelming and seemingly invincible enemy. Darius's son and successor, Xerxes, would fare no better. When the Spartans' famous and sacrificial stand at the Battle of Thermopylae ended, the Athenian fleet was forced to fall back, and Xerxes's massive Persian army marched unopposed into Greece before advancing on Athens. The Greek armies were scattered and unable to face the might of Persia, so Athens was forced to do the unthinkable: evacuate the entire population of the city to Salamis, from where the Athenians watched in horror as Xerxes's troops plundered the defenceless city, set it aflame, and razed the Acropolis. However, the Athenians remained belligerent, in part because, according to the oracle at Delphi, only the wooden wall shall save you. Indeed, this would prove true when Themistocles managed to lure the Persian fleet into the Straits of Salamis. There, on a warm day in September 480 BCE, hundreds of Greek and Persian ships faced each other in a narrow strait between the Attic peninsula of Greece and the island of Salamis. The battle that ensued would prove to be epic on a number of different levels, as it set a precedent for how later naval battles were fought in the ancient Mediterranean, turned the tide in the Greeks' favour against the Persians in the Persian Wars, and ultimately played a role in Athens's rise to a preeminent role in the Hellenic world. In terms of geopolitics, perhaps the most seminal event of the Middle Ages was a successful Ottoman siege of Constantinople in 1453. The city had been an imperial capital as far back as the 4th century, when Constantine the Great shifted the power centre of the Roman Empire there, effectively establishing two almost equally powerful halves of antiquity's greatest empire. Constantinople would continue to serve as the capital of the Byzantine Empire even after the western half of the Roman Empire collapsed in the late 5th century. Naturally, the Ottoman Empire would also use Constantinople as the capital of its empire after their conquest effectively ended the Byzantine Empire, and, thanks to its strategic location, it has been a trading centre for years and remains one today under the Turkish name of Istanbul. The end of the Byzantine Empire had a profound effect not only on the Middle East, but Europe as well. Constantinople had played a crucial part in the Crusades, and the fall of the Byzantines meant that the Ottomans now shared a border with Europe. The Islamic Empire was viewed as a threat by the predominantly Christian continent to their west, and it took little time for different European nations to start clashing with the powerful Turks. In fact, the Ottomans would clash with Russians, Austrians, Venetians, Polish, and more before collapsing as a result of World War I, when they were part of the Central Powers. The Ottoman conquest of Constantinople also played a decisive role in fostering the Renaissance in Western Europe. The Byzantine Empire's influence had helped ensure that it was the custodian of various ancient texts, most notably from the ancient Greeks, and when Constantinople fell, Byzantine refugees flocked west to seek refuge in Europe. Those refugees brought books that helped spark an interest in antiquity that fueled the Italian Renaissance and essentially put an end to the Middle Ages altogether. In the wake of taking Constantinople, the Ottoman Empire would spend the next few centuries expanding its size, power, and influence, bumping up against Eastern Europe and becoming one of the world's most important geopolitical players. It was a rise that would not truly start to wane until the 19th century. The long agony of the sick man of Europe, an expression used by the Tsar of Russia to depict the falling Ottoman Empire, could almost blind people to its incredible power and history. Preserving its mixed heritage, coming from both its geographic position, rising above the ashes of the Byzantine Empire and the tradition inherited from the Muslim conquests, the Ottoman Empire lasted more than 6 centuries. Its soldiers fought, died, and conquered lands on 3 different continents, making it one of the few stable multi-ethnic empires in history, and likely one of the last. Thus, it's somewhat inevitable that the history of its decline is at the heart of complex geopolitical disputes, as well as sectarian tensions that are still key to understanding the Middle East, North Africa, and the Balkans. When studying the fall of the Ottoman Empire, historians have argued over the breaking point that saw a leading global power slowly become a decadent empire. The failed Battle of Vienna in 1683 is certainly an important turning point for the expanding empire, as the defeat of Grand Vizier Kara Mustafa Pasha at the hands of a coalition led by the Austrian Habsburg dynasty, Holy Roman Empire, and Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth marked the end of Ottoman expansionism. It was also the beginning of a slow decline, during which the Ottoman Empire suffered multiple military defeats, found itself mired by corruption, and had to deal with the increasingly mutinous Janissaries, the empire's initial foot soldiers. Despite it all, the Ottoman Empire would survive for over 200 more years, and in the last century of its life it strove to reform its military, administration and economy until it was finally dissolved. Years before the final collapse of the empire, the Tanzimat reorganization, a period of swiping reforms, led to significant changes in the country's military apparatus, among others, which certainly explains the initial success the Ottoman Empire was able to achieve against its rivals. Similarly, the drafting of a new constitution, Kanun-i-Isazi, Basic Law, in 1876, despite it being shot down by Sultan Abdul Hamid II just 2 years later, as well as its revival by the Young Turks movement in 1908, highlights the understanding among Ottoman elites that change was needed, and their belief that such change was possible. Looking at the events of the empire's last two centuries and interpreting the fall of the Ottoman Empire as a slow but long decline is what could be called the accepted narrative. At the start of World War I, the Ottoman Empire was often described as a dwindling power, mired by administrative corruption, using inferior technology, and plagued by poor leadership. The general idea is that the Ottoman Empire was lagging behind, likely coming from the clear stagnation of the empire between 1683 and 1826. Yet it can be argued that this portrayal is often misleading and fails to give a fuller picture of the state of the Ottoman Empire. The fact that the other existing multicultural empire, namely the Austro-Hungarian Empire, also did not survive World War I, should put into question this accepted narrative. Looking at the reforms, technological advances and modernization efforts made by the Ottoman elite between 1826 and the beginning of World War I, one could really wonder why such a thirst for change failed to save the Ottomans, when similar measures taken by other nations, such as Japan during the Meiji era, did in fact result in the rise of a global power in the 20th century. During the period that preceded its collapse, the Ottoman Empire was at the heart of a growing rivalry between two of the competing global powers of the time, England and France. The two powers asserted their influence over a declining empire, the history of which is anchored in Europe as much as in Asia. However, while the two powers were instrumental in the final defeat and collapse of the Ottoman Empire, their stance toward what came to be known as the Eastern Question, the fate of the Ottoman Empire, is not one of clear enmity. Both England and France found, at times, reasons to extend the life of the sick man of Europe until it finally sided with their shared enemies. Russia's stance towards the Ottoman Empire is much more clear-cut. The rising Asian and European powers saw the Ottomans as a rival, which they strove to contain, divide, and finally destroy for more than 300 years in a series of wars against their old adversary. Last but not least, the rise of nationalism among peoples under Ottoman domination was a key factor in the dissolution of the empire. At the end of the 19th century, shortly before its final collapse, the territory of the Ottoman Empire dwindled due to the growing call for independence coming from different ethnicities it ruled for hundreds of years. The empire's inclusiveness, which marked it as a direct successor of the Byzantine Empire, was most certainly challenged by an aging leadership. The Ottoman Empire's inability to create a shared identity, a weak central state, and growing inner dissensions were some of the main factors explaining its long demise. Such a failure also explains the need for the creation of a new form of identity, which was ultimately provided by Mustafa Kemal, the founding father of modern Turkey. Overall, the history of the dissolution can be defined as a race between the empire's growing illness, on one side, the Ottomans' inability to appease and federate the various people within its territory, and constant attempts to find a cure in the form of broad reforms. These questions are often presented together, but that tends to shift the focus outward onto the various peoples and their aspirations, along with Europe's growing influence over the fate of the Ottoman Empire. To consider both the illness and the cure, it's necessary to separate them, before moving on to the direct cause of the empire's dissolution, World War I, and its heritage. A concise history of Turkey, the history and legacy of Turkey from antiquity to today, then, provides a brief but comprehensive overview of Turkey over the past 3,000 years. Ancient Anatolia. The standard encyclopedia definition of Anatolia, known also as Asia Minor or the Anatolian Plateau, describes a peninsula of land defining the westernmost protrusion of Asia. More than two-thirds of modern Turkey comprises the Anatolian Plateau, which, besides its many human and geographic fascinations, places modern Turkey precisely at the crossroads between the East and the West. It is this unique position that has shaped and defined both the ancient and modern history of this unique nation, and no doubt will continue to do so. The character of Anatolia as a distinct region, and as its name implies, is that of a high plateau extending from the steppes of Central Asia to the coast of the Aegean, bordered to the east by the hills and mountain chains of Armenia, to the south by the rugged Taurus Mountains, and to the north by the Black Sea. The former serves as a natural barrier between Turkey and Iran, and the latter between Turkey and the low-lying regions of Syria and Iraq. To the west, smaller mountain ranges that run east to west plunge into the Aegean Sea, surfacing periodically as the Greek islands. The Black Sea is linked to the Aegean via the Sea of Marmara, the Bosporus, and the Straits of the Dardanelles. Asia Minor forms something of a northwestern extension to the region known as Mesopotamia, broadly between the Tigris and the Euphrates, which is today regarded as the cradle of civilization. Here was the first human transition from the nomadic lifestyles of the hunter-gatherer to the settled conditions of agricultural and pastoral styles of life. Although the first evidence of human habitation on the Anatolian Plateau can be reasonably accurately dated to the Paleolithic period, 500,000 to 12,000 BCE, the first settled human societies practicing agriculture and animal husbandry begin to appear only during the Neolithic period, beginning at around 10,000 BCE. This is what archaeologists now refer to as the Neolithic Revolution, a great leap forward in human evolution that set in motion the long march towards human civilization as we recognize it today. It is extraordinary to imagine that the visible antiquities of modern Turkey, Iraq, and Iran are overlaid upon even more ancient layers of human civilization, lost in an era of prehistory before written chronicles and with just the scantest surviving archaeological record. The Eastern Mediterranean and the expanses of Asia Minor have been the subject of intensive and ongoing archaeological work since the early Victorian era. One of the most extensive and best-preserved Neolithic settlements to be discovered during this period was Çatal Huyek, located in the southern Anatolian region southeast of the modern city of Konya, and which has fascinated generations of archaeologists. Interest in the site was prompted by the British amateur archaeologist David George Hogarth, a contemporary of another great scholar, orientalist and soldier, Thomas Edward Lawrence. Hogarth made note of a local legend claiming that Konya was the first human settlement of any size to emerge after the Great Flood. The site upon which the settlement was built lies on the edge of an ancient lake, which might perhaps have been the source of the legend, but at the very least the alluvial deposits left behind by the receding waters were sufficiently fertile to support what became, in practical terms, the first known human city. The site is extensive, covering some 32 acres, and its civic architecture comprised simple, single-story mud brick structures, mostly domestic dwellings, which were built in a manner that suggests the need not only for shelter, but also defence. The economy of the settlement was primarily centred around agriculture, but local deposits of obsidian were also important for the manufacture of tools and implements before the development of iron, and representing the first items of prehistoric trade. Another unique and interesting feature of Çatal Huyek is the number of